You may recall that we last week introduced the first part of Gospel of John, chapter 6, where a large crowd followed Jesus into a wilderness area, and where he is preparing to miraculously take care of their needs. We're told that Jesus saw this large crowd coming to him and said to Philip in John 6 and verse 5, "Where are we to buy bread that these might eat?" He was saying this, the very next verse tells us, John 6 and verse 6, to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. And we talked about that quite a bit. We looked at verse 7 where the supplies for the people were somewhat insufficient. Philip said 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are these for so many people?" And we talked about these verses a little bit and made a few practical points that we might be able to appreciate if we would stop and meditate on those passages a little bit and try to put ourselves in that situation, in that setting. So tonight we'd like to look at the abundant surplus in the rest of the passage, beginning in verse 10. Jesus commanded his disciples to have the people sit down. John tells us, "Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, in number about 5,000. Jesus then took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, likewise also of the fish, as much as they wanted." So we can learn something about Jesus taking charge of a situation, and about how he arranges people in an orderly fashion, more than likely so there would be some pathway for the disciples to make distribution among this large, very large number of people to make sure that everyone was fed. So Jesus organized the group into smaller companies, we're told in Mark's Gospel, chapter 6, 39 and 40. And all of the miracles that Jesus ever did, out of all of them, this was, if you think about it, the most massive miracle in terms of the number of people participating in it, if you want to put it that way. It's striking. When you add everybody up, we're told that it was 5,000 men. Are we to believe that there were not women there? Are we to believe that there were not children there? So just making a conservative estimate about how many people this could have been, maybe 20,000 or more. And Jesus creates a meal for each one of them. Before the distribution, Jesus was host to the gathering and he offered thanks to God. You and I can learn a great lesson from that. Whatever we do, whatever we are given, whatever we receive, whatever we eat, whatever we drink, we should do all to the glory of God as Paul did in 1 Corinthians 10, 30 and 31. And Jesus exemplifies that principle for us right here in this passage. It's interesting to me that here is a situation where the people are famished and they're out in the middle of nowhere. No convenience store to be able to stop and get something to drink and something to snack on, and a snack probably would not have taken care of them since they had been a long time without eating. They were famished, and they were satisfied by the Lord. Every need was met. That's significant, I think, don't you? As Jesus was distributing the bread and the fish to his disciples, it was being multiplied in his hands. He called bread into existence that had never been in an oven, was made of barley, never grown in any farmer's field, fish that never swam in any lake with other fish, would never be caught by any fisherman's net. Jesus provided that. Earlier, Philip had done the math, you recall, that proved that it was impossible for them to feed all of these people. Now, he's watching Jesus calmly perform what is impossible in the eyes of men. John tells us that when it was all said and done, everyone had as much to eat as he wanted. No person said, "Oh, I'll just take a little bit because there's such a small portion here." Every person ate to their fill. I think that's somewhat significant too. Isn't it just like putting yourself in that situation and thinking, "I'm there and I'm seeing this." Isn't it like a motion picture of the Lord's great compassion for people? In verse 12, John records for us, when they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. The expression, "as much as they would," and "when they were filled," describe the nature of the miracle, the extent of the miracle that Jesus performed on this occasion. All of the people were completely satisfied, and there were fragments that were left over. No one went away hungry. How could there have been leftovers from a meal with so many present, with so little to eat, unless a genuine supernatural act of miraculous creation occurred in the hand of our Master by the power of God, our Creator? There's no other answer for it, is it? The bounty of food provided is proved in the amount of leftovers that were gathered, I think. These were the leftovers taken by people as much as they want. "I'm finished eating. I don't want any more." Not only were these leftovers from this meal, but there were many times more fragments, if you think about it, many times more fragments collected than the original amount that was provided by the young lad. 12 full baskets. I don't know what size the baskets were, but I know that that's a great deal more than was provided by the lad. Do you think there might be a lesson here about taking up the fragments? And if there is, then maybe it's the lesson of, even if there is an infinite amount of something supplied to you by your Creator, that you and I should not be wasteful with it. Some have suggested that's a powerful lesson in this context, that an overabundance of something is not an excuse for waste. And that sounds reasonable to reasonable people, doesn't it? God provides us with an abundance of a lot of things. And we may freely take and use all we want. But there's just something uncomfortable if we start wasting things that He's abundantly supplied us with, isn't there? That's kind of a balance between being stingy or being excessive in things. Rejoice and be glad in the blessings that God bestows upon you. But do not squander or waste those blessings. They're significant. Consider that the reason you may have an abundance is for the very purpose of sharing with someone else who has a need, whose need can be supplied, and can be supplied through you as a Christian. Even here, the leftovers would have provided for the Lord and the disciples' needs for that day and the next. Interestingly, when we come to verse 14, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, this was their conclusion, "This is truly the prophet who has come into the world." They're convinced because of their participation in this great miracle. Their recollection of what happened on this occasion reminded them of something that Moses said a long, long time ago. Maybe it reminded them of Elijah in the Old Testament, and the jar of flour, and the cruse of oil in 1 Kings chapter 17. Of Elisha and his miracle with the oil pot in 2 Kings 4. Elisha's feeding of 100 men with 20 loaves of bread and fresh ears of grain in 2 Kings chapter 4. And especially reminded them of Moses feeding God's people through the manna and the quail in the wilderness. Do you think that those type of thoughts in the mind, maybe not every person was thinking of that, but surely out of 20,000 plus people, some people were remembering those things about their own history and concluding, leading them to this conclusion, the one who performed this miracle is the one that Moses referred to when he said, there's a greater prophet coming and you're to listen to him when he comes. He was not merely seen as a prophet, but as the prophet that Moses particularly promised in Deuteronomy 18:15 and Deuteronomy 18:18. In other words, the Messiah. The people understood the significance of the miracle. The miracle was plain to see. And because of this miracle, they recognized that Jesus was indeed, at least at this point in time, Jesus is indeed the prophet that Moses spoke about that's coming into the world, and we should hear him. The problem is they didn't really understand the ministry that the prophet that would come into the world of which Moses spoke, they didn't really understand the ministry that he would bring into the world with him when he came. They didn't really understand that he would disrupt their false notions and their false beliefs and tell them the more significant truths that they needed to understand from God. They only thought of him in terms of political power at this point in their lives and the restoration of Israel to its former glory and getting rid of the Romans who are occupying our country. That's the way they were thinking of the Messiah, but the next verse indicates for us the intentions they had to act upon their belief. Okay, this is the Messiah that's coming into the world. Moses spoke to us about him. And in verse 15, Jesus, perceiving that they were intending to come and taking him by force to make him king, withdrew again to the mountain by himself alone. Didn't Jesus come to be recognized as king by his people? Certainly he did. These Galileans viewed Jesus as the second Moses, who, like the first Moses, fed them in the wilderness miraculously. Here's the one that Moses spoke about. And beyond this, they felt that surely he has come to deliver us from the oppression that we are under, not the oppression of wandering around in the wilderness, but the political oppression, not the oppression of the Egyptian bondage, like Moses had delivered his people from, but bondage provided them by the Romans are in our country. These Gentiles, these pagans are in our country. They're running things. We want them out of here. So they saw him as an answer to their prayers that the wicked Romans in their Herodian poems might be ever vanquished and Israel might be redeemed from their political oppressors. So this is more than likely what they had in mind when they came to make Jesus king by force. By force, by popular acclaim. In order to make him king, probably in Jerusalem, they would probably carry him right into Jerusalem and take over the throne and set him on the throne. But surprisingly, maybe to some people, even though Jesus came with the intention to be king over God's people, he didn't want it in this way. And he didn't want to be king based on their false notions of what his kingship would be all about. So rather than accepting this royal honor that they're offering and thinking about and planning, Jesus withdrew alone into the wilderness area, the Golan Heights, the mountains of the region, which you and I probably really wouldn't call mountains. We'd probably more refer to them more as hills. Sending the disciples away across the lake. Recall that Jesus had refused to honor the devil during his temptation in the wilderness. In Matthew 4, 8 through 10. So here, Jesus also refuses something. He refuses to allow these people with their notions the opportunity to come and make him an earthly king. He didn't come for an earthly kingship. It was never the plan of God that Christ should reign over a physical territory on the earth or the promised land as its king. His kingdom was not of this world. Never of this world. John 18 and verse 36. And his kingdom is still not of this world. Those of the premillennial and dispensational persuasion really ought to listen to this passage and really ought to contemplate, why didn't Jesus go along with it? When Jesus had the chance to become an earthly king, he turned it down. And he would refuse that even today. He stands by his truth that he's already revealed. My principle, my kingdom doesn't involve this temporal realm. My kingdom is spiritual. My kingdom is eternal. My kingdom is of a different realm, not of this earth. The kingdom has a future dimension, yes. But even then, it's not a carnal, earthly, temporal fulfillment of a kingdom. It's the final culmination of the promise of being a citizen in God's eternal kingdom, heaven, after the temporal life has already been lived. So yes, there is a future aspect as far as you and I looking for the kingdom, but we can very much be in his kingdom today. It's interesting to me that Jesus was never overwhelmed by the circumstances surrounding him, by the events that were closing in on him, and he never did lose control of a situation. That takes a man's man, doesn't it? Never lost control of a situation. He remained in control of what he would do and when he would do it. You know, he created a lot of enemies during his time teaching. How is it that none of those enemies ever got close enough to him to thrust him through with a sword or catch him in a back alley and knife him in the back? How is it that none of that ever happened? How is it that his death was a public display, a part of the permanent historical record that could never be refuted? Have you ever thought about that? And now it wouldn't be very long until there wouldn't be a mob coming to him to make him king by force, but there would be a mob. And what would they say? Crucify him. Crucify him. Not very long from this time. Why was it at that moment the mob acclaimed Jesus? We want this guy as our king. And yet later, we don't want anything to do with this guy. What made the difference? For one thing, they were eager to support Jesus when he gave them what they wanted. Now, don't you think people in our world today would be happy to follow Jesus if he just dispensed to them every little thing that they ever wanted? Knowing human nature, what would your conclusion about that be? Do you think more people would follow Jesus if that were the case? He'd heal them. He fed them. What more would you want in a great leader? But there's such a thing as a bought loyalty, isn't there? The neighborhood cat will love you so long as you feed it. But when you stop feeding it, what? It's off somewhere else, isn't it? You and I should make sure that we are different, that we don't operate that way. When we want comfort in sorrow, when we want strength in difficulty, when we want peace in turmoil, when we want help in the face of depression, when we want to overcome the bad things in life, there is no one so wonderful to us than Jesus Christ. And no one who can do anything about it any more powerful than Jesus Christ. But when he comes to us with a command for sacrifice or some challenge to that requires effort on our part, some request from him to learn not how to be proud but learn how to be humble, with the offer of persecution for righteousness' sake, we'll draw back sometimes if we don't want anything to do with it. Is that out of kilter with the way these people were thinking? When we examine our hearts, it may be that we find that we too love Jesus just for what we can get out of him. And that's really not the right motive. For another thing, they wished to use Jesus for their own purposes. They were waiting for the Messiah, that's true, but they visualized the Messiah in their own way. He's going to fit into this mold. They already predetermined who the Messiah would be and what he would do, what kind of king he would be, and he would be a conqueror driving the Romans from the land. They had seen what Jesus could do. They had seen his great power over nature, and if they had been honest, they would have had to admit that they wished to make use of him. Don't you think? Knowing again human nature and the way people operate, and especially in the political realm, wouldn't you think that would be the case? That they wished to make use of him? Again, are we so very different? When we appeal to Christ, is it for strength to go on with our own schemes and our own ideas, or is it for humility to subject ourselves to his will, strength to be obedient to his difficult commands, to accept his plans and accept his will and his wishes for our lives? Is our prayer, Lord, give me the strength to do what you want me to do? Or is our prayer, Lord, give me the strength to do what I want to do? And sometimes there's a difference there. That crowd of Jews would have followed Jesus at that moment because he was giving them exactly what they wanted. And they wished to use him for their own purposes. And that attitude that people have still lingers, even today. We would like Christ's gifts. We would like to receive his gifts, but without his cross, without his suffering, without his persecution. We'd like to use him instead of allowing him to use us. There's a difference. Jesus certainly desired to be accepted as God's Messiah, and this would have been his moment, because here's thousands and thousands of people who are backing his plan. If he was just a man with ambition. But he wasn't just a man with ambition. He's God's Son. He's not there to allow them to succeed with their ambitions. And he's not there to allow them to push him to become the kind of king that they wanted. And that's the way it is today. And a lot of our religious neighbors need to wake up to that principle. The Lord's not here to be the kind of Lord that you want him to be. He's here to be the kind of Lord to subject you to his will and have you follow his teaching and learn about him. And there's a difference, don't you think? Jesus does not come to man on man's terms. People can't manipulate Jesus to their own personal and private selfish ends. He calls on sinners to mourn for their sin, to be brokenhearted over their sins, to be penitent, and to acknowledge him as the sovereign Lord and to be obedient to him and to live for him and to think of him, pray for him, die for him, serve him as a slave, suffer for him if we're called upon to do that. Be persecuted for righteousness' sake if we're called upon to do that. That's the kind of discipleship that he offers. So wherever you find the broad way that many people may take, it's because more than likely they haven't heard the demands of the gospel. Didn't Jesus say something about counting the cost before you put your hand to the plow? Because when you put your hand to the plow as a disciple, you're not to look back. This was a staggering opportunity for them to affirm that he's the Son of God. They were all on his side at this time, and he's the prophet that Moses spoke about. And for them to say, teach us what is true from God, whatever it is, that's what we want and that's what we'll do. That would have been an entirely different situation. He'll give that great discourse on himself as the bread of life, and he'll talk about eternal riches, and he'll talk about heaven, and he'll talk about salvation, but in the final analysis, they'll reject what he says about it. That has to call for our interest. If we're interested in nothing other than how human beings think and behave, those things should raise an eyebrow of interest. What does all this mean to us? How can we apply this? How is this practical for us? We find in Jesus' departure from Capernaum that there is a time and a place to remove oneself from danger. Jesus did that. He didn't go out looking for persecution. It would find him soon enough. We do not act from fear, but we do act from wisdom. To learn wisdom from God and continue our service to him. We also found in this example that it's good to seek and spend time alone. That was his intention when he left Capernaum to go into the wilderness. It wasn't his intention for thousands and thousands of people to meet him out there so that they could have a teaching session. He'd already taught. He was already exhausted. His disciples were exhausted. They needed some rest time. They needed some downtime. And that's why they went out there in the wilderness. It's good for us to have some downtime too. To seek to be with God in prayer. To relax. To approach his throne confidently. To be alone. Jesus' demonstration of compassion is also a model for us. Life isn't really about what's convenient for us. And we as people need to get it through our heads. It's not all about me. It's not all about me. It's about God and his will and his character. And his character I must take upon myself. Life is not for our convenience. It's about serving the Lord. And ministering to other people is not always convenient. Yet as we see people through God's love, we reach out sacrificially to meet their needs. But we also have to remember that true ministry necessarily involves telling people about Jesus Christ. Yes, we should help meet the needs of other people in the physical realm. Yes, we certainly should. But our real purpose in life is to teach them the gospel and show them the way of Jesus Christ and give them the opportunity to embrace spiritual things if they so choose. We also find that God's timing doesn't really have to match our plans. But there is a blessing in yielding to God. Remember that Jesus and the disciples originally had set out to spend some time alone. Jesus was going to give them further instruction. He does just that with the circumstances at hand, but the circumstances were a little overwhelming with all of these people. I think that's a good reminder to parents that it is often in unforeseen circumstances where we can make a deep impression on our children with some spiritual truth and we never really saw it coming. It just happens in the circumstances where we find ourselves. We can teach our children some of the greatest lessons about God and about how to live for God? Are you ready to teach your children in any and every circumstance? Another lesson here is that we need not question the wisdom of God asking us to obey Him. It is enough for us to know that God loves us and wants what is best for us. And we must, by faith, embrace that, whatever it is. Whatever it is. He will enable us to do what He asked us to do. The task that Jesus charged His disciples with was really impossible for them. But that may be one of the main points of why John is writing this to us. They would be sent out to do what was impossible by every reasonable means of human endeavor. And they would see it as something impossible for them to do. But the disciples were to be taught, what do you do in those situations? When things look impossible to you, who do you turn to? And maybe it's to reinforce this concept, when things look so impossible to you, you look to Christ. You look to God. That's where the answer is found. And that's where our answers are found even today. We may regard parenting responsibilities as impossible. How can a mother or a father, both who are imperfect, and we'll be the first to admit it as parents, won't we? How can a mother and father who are both imperfect instill within their children a love for the perfect Jesus Christ? And yet that's the challenge, isn't it? Imbibe His teachings. Hear His teachings. Incorporate them into your life. Be like He is. Does that seem like a daunting task? How can a mother or father who are imperfect carry out the responsibility of raising godly children? I think that's a pretty good question. Children do imitate what they see in their parents. And that alone strikes fear in our hearts sometimes, doesn't it? They're good at imitating what they see in parents. The task is impossible for us alone. But the task is not impossible if we're faithful to the task and rely on God to provide what we cannot. And we can do it. The apostles were just like us. All they could see in front of them was an impossible task, even though the one who could do the impossible was right there with them. Right there with them. Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever faced a trial in your life that seems to you to be totally impossible to deal with? Many have. And many more than one. To whom did you turn? Where did you go? Where did you look? Remember that God does not require success from us. All He requires of us is we're faithful to what He's told us to believe and do. That's all He requires of us. And He'll handle the rest. It is God Himself that works out the end result. And I'm so very thankful for that, aren't you? Because how many end results have I tried to work out for myself and what happened? And how many end results have you tried to work out for yourself and what happened? Let God take care of the end result. We're to have the faith of a child that fully expects his father to provide. It's not a matter of our understanding why he wants us to do something. It is a matter of trusting Him to know what is best for us and that we will be able to do it and or He will be there to help us every step of the way. And that takes faith. Now where is your faith tonight? How strong is it tonight? Little is much with God. You get that from this? Section, you think? Have you been brought to a point of belief in Jesus by this time in our look at John's Gospel? That's the whole purpose of the Gospel of John, to demonstrate that this man, Jesus, who lived in the nation of Israel, who was born in the little town of Bethlehem, who lived his life in Nazareth, came to Jerusalem, ministered across the nation, died, was buried, was raised again from the dead, ascended to God in heaven, and promised to return, that same Jesus is fully God in human form. He is divine. He is God's Son. And believing that, you may have eternal life, God's free gift to you. And have you been brought to that point of belief by your study of John's Gospel thus far? And if you have, you can do something about that tonight. You can be baptized in Christ for the remission of sins. And we'll all embrace you and welcome you into the fellowship of believers here. Is that your desire? Will you respond to the invitation of Christ tonight? If you will, just come to the front, let me know about it. And it'll be simple. We'll take care of it, and you'll be a new person when you leave this building. Can we help you? If we can, please respond to the invitation of Christ while together we stand and sing the invitation song.